And the next case is Foster versus Riedel, 2014 CA 2287. And counsel, I think both of you were in the room when I went through the practices and proceed in the courtroom before. Do you have any questions about the practices and procedures for oral argument today?
No, Your Honor. I do not.
All right, thank you. And also be advised, I don't recall that this would have any sensitive material in this case, but we are live streaming anyway, just so you're aware of that and keep that in mind. Other than that, everybody else left the courtroom, so we don't have to talk about cell phones being turned off, unless you're the council have cell phones. I know one time my cell phone went off after I made that warning, and I had it in my pocket, so I was feeling a little embarrassed at that time. But we're ready to proceed if you are. Mr. Toft.
May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Andrew Toft. My registration number is 12550. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Scott Foster, who was the plaintiff in the trial court. We're here before the court today requesting the reversal of the trial court's orders, two orders, one of them dated October 9, 2014, the second one dated November 17th, 2014, under 16-5-209, and we're asking the court to order the appointment of a special prosecutor pursuant to 16-5-209 to prosecute Brian Hardwin and John Plock for a theft of medical records under section 18-4-412. I think one of the critical issues, Your Honors, that the trial court misunderstood in making its ruling, at least with regard to Mr. Hardwin, is what Mr. Hardwin knew and when he knew it. On page 8 of the October 9 order, Judge Odell stated that there was a dearth of evidence that Mr. Hardwin knew the PREs contained confidential information. However, if you go to the record in the court file pages 66 and 67, there is a document that was prepared by the appellee's office, and it's a summary of the events in this case, and in particular with regard to two misdemeanor matters that Mr. Foster was involved in and the issue of PREs, the parental responsibility evaluations that were disclosed by Mr. Plock to Mr. Hardwin. This document, which was Exhibit 2, I believe, to plaintiff's complaint, says that on March 5 or 6 of 2013, Mr. Hardwin and Mr. Foster's divorce attorney, Mrs. Foster's divorce attorney, who was John Plock, had a telephone conversation. Mr. Hardwin asked Mr. Plock whether Mr. Plock has anything that may be of assistance in the criminal case, because Mr. Foster had been charged in a criminal proceeding that had not yet gone to trial. Mr. Plock was already representing Mr. Foster's now ex-wife in the divorce proceeding. So Mr. Plock, Mr. Hardwin were discussing whether or not Mr. Plock had anything that would be useful in the divorce case, the criminal case. Mr. Plock commented that he has a report showing that the defendant, Mr. Foster, the appellant here, has mental health issues. And he agreed to send Mr. Hardwin, the prosecutor, a copy of those records.
Mr. Toft, if I could.
Yes, Your Honor.
I have read in the briefs the background that you're providing us right now, and I really want to focus a little bit more on the legal question. I noticed that the Supreme Court this week denied cert on the Rule 50, and it looked like, when I went back and looked at the petition for cert, that there was a great deal of emphasis on the legal issue concerning whether or not the PREs constitute a medical information or not, and so forth. It looks like what the trial court said is it doesn't matter for purposes of my analysis, because I'm weighing the equitable considerations, and when I weigh the equitable considerations, I come out against Mr. Foster in this case. why wouldn't we defer to the trial court when the standard is so high in this case?
Your Honor, I think that this is a circumstance where the legislature has given the courts an opportunity to act when a prosecutor fails to act in the case that should be prosecuted. And I think that this is a proper circumstance for the court to review what the trial court decided. I don't think, for example, that the trial court's asking the question of what is to be gained. I don't think that that's even the proper consideration under 16.5209. I don't think it matters, for example, as in the exchange I had with the trial court, that, you know, this may harm Mr. Plock in his, for example, in his professional life. I think that all that matters is, was this an arbitrary and a capricious decision by the prosecutor not to prosecute? And was it without reasonable excuse? And it's the appellant's position that it was arbitrary and capricious without reasonable excuse. For example, the PREs themselves. Now, I don't think the PRE as a whole, it necessarily matters whether that's a medical record or not. I think the information that is contained in that medical record can be a, or contained in the PRE can be a medical record standing by itself. Here, when the district attorney made its decision, it is clear from the record that the district attorney did not review the PREs, didn't even look at them to know what they contained and whether or not they had medical records in them. Those PREs were not in the possession of the district attorney's office after November 21st of 2013. There is a notation in the record that says they had been destroyed prior to that date. Mm-hmm. And every time that the issue came up where the 20th Judicial District Attorney's Office looked at the information and decided that Mr. Hardwin should not be prosecuted, when the 8th Judicial District Attorney's Office looked at the affidavit for the arrest of John Plock that Officer Dayton of the Fort Collins Police Department had issued, and when I wrote my letter and Mr. Riedel responded on May 7th of 2014, they said these are not within the scope of the statute, they're not medical records, therefore we're not going to prosecute. They didn't have the PRE in front of them. They didn't have the mental health information about my client in front of them to be able to evaluate whether or not this is in fact a medical record. They had nothing. They simply looked at the statute, looked at the facts, looked at the fact that it was somebody in their own office who had participated in what we consider to be a crime, and said, we're not going to prosecute. They didn't do an investigation. In oral argument before the trial court, I believe that Mr. Vandenberg, on behalf of the appellee, specifically stated, said, I struggle with the idea that in this case, with the idea of investigation. I struggle with the idea of that in this case because what he's suggesting is we need to do an investigation to determine what the definition of medical records or medical information is. We don't need to do that investigation. It's in the statute. We looked at it, we don't think it applies, and we made a decision based on that. So there's no investigation to do on that. They decided without knowing what was in the PRE. They just said, all we're going to do is look at the statute. We're not going to look at the facts. We're not going to look at what Mr. Hardwin knew based upon what Mr. Plock told him, that he was going to receive information about my client's mental health. All we're doing is looking at the statute. We don't care about Officer Dayton's investigation and that he thinks there was a crime committed here. I understand that it's the district attorney's responsibility to make the decision to prosecute. But if you look at all the work that Officer Dayton put in, the conversation that he had with Mr. Plock, the outcome of that, and all they say is there's not enough information, there's not a basis for prosecution, this isn't a medical record, so we're not going to prosecute. It was arbitrary and capricious and without a reasonable excuse to deny prosecution without even knowing what those PREs said.
So would you have us remand back to the trial court for the purpose of reviewing in camera what the PRE said, or what would you have us do at this point?
Your Honor, I think that this court can look at the PREs itself and make that decision itself at this time. It can, they're in the court record in the divorce proceeding. I think, as I alluded to in my brief, I think that the court can take judicial notice of what's in the court's records and can look at them and reach that evaluation themselves or yourselves that whether or not there is a medical record. Alternatively, if this court is not comfortable with that, I would remand it to the trial court to make a determination of whether or not the information contained in there is a medical record. But I don't think that it is anything but an arbitrary and capricious decision by the prosecution to just say, in essence, we don't care that the legislature passed this law making this a crime. We don't care that there were mental health issues discussed in these documents. All we're going to do is look at it and say, we don't think the PRE statute, when we compare that to the medical records theft statute, we don't think they go together. And so we're not going to prosecute. I think that it's very clear from the medical theft statute, medical record theft statute, and the revisions that were made in 2007 to specifically add health information and mental health issues to the statute, that it's clear that that is intended to be covered and that the situation here is expressly intended to be covered by the theft of medical records statute. Similarly, if you look at 25.1, 1201, and 1202, cited in the brief, it's an index of medical record confidentiality information. And both the PRE statute and the theft of medical record statute fall under there. So I think it's very clear from the perspective of the legislature that mental health information and information that is contained in PREs relating to parties' mental health, and even their medical health should be protected under the theft of medical records statute.
Counsel, I just wanted to follow up with what Judge Roman asked you, but I'm trying to figure out what our role is here, kind of what the standard is. So let's say we did a very thorough statutory construction review and we decided, you know what, those are medical records. And then we say what? Like, well, this is a pretty good case because we think these are medical records. Pretty good case. So you should really prosecute. Is that what our role is?
I think the court's role is to make a determination that this was an arbitrary and capricious decision, that the trial court judge's two orders should be reversed, and I think this court can direct that a special prosecutor be appointed to prosecute this case. I don't think that the 8th Judicial District Attorney's Office can prosecute it because it's their own employee who is potentially involved in this and certainly will be a material witness against Mr. Plock if he's not prosecuted himself.
Well, is there any room for like reasonable disagreement about the meaning of the statute? So what if at the time, I mean, the trial court, I think, sort of generally assumed that maybe they were medical records and then said, but that's okay because there are these other reasons. What about a reasonable difference of opinion? Some people think they're medical records, some people don't. Is there any room for that kind of a disagreement?
Well, I think that if the court were to examine the information, I don't think that there would be a reasonable basis for disagreement. I think that based on what I understand is in the PREs, because I have not seen them, Your Honor, myself, I'm not divorce counsel, so I can't see them. But if there is mental health information in there from mental health providers about Mr. Foster, I don't think under the statute there is much question in my mind that reasonable minds can differ about the fact that they are medical records.
Okay, and then moving on to these other considerations that the trial court set forth in the order, it sounds like you take exception with the fact that the prosecutor relied on National District Attorney Association prosecution standards in determining whether or not to prosecute. And I'm wondering why you have an objection to that.
Well, Your Honor, I think if you look at the documents that were created at the actual time that this issue was being decided by the prosecutor's office, there's no reference to those standards. This decision was made solely on how they looked at the statute. I think that the reference to the national prosecution standards only came into play after the 16-5209 petition was drafted. If you look at Mr. Riedel's letter to me, there's no reference to those national prosecution standards. All he talks about is the medical record statute. If you look at the information in Officer Dayton's report, it doesn't say anything about prosecution standards. It just says that he was told these aren't medical records, and we don't think there's enough information to prosecute. They may not be pretextual, but I think they're certainly posttextual as a reason for why this was done. I don't think at the time any of those were considered by the prosecution. Is there a factual basis in the record for that statement? No, Your Honor, there's not. But if you look at the 20th Judicial District Attorney's letter of May 10th, 2013, if you look at Officer Dayton's report and what he was told by the District Attorney's office, and if you look at the letter that Mr. Riedel sent to me in May of 2014, they don't reference any of those standards. And I don't think that they were considered at the time. And I don't think they should be applied in this case. I think you go with what's in the record is what was actually done. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toth.
May it please the court, David Vinberg, registration 38258, on behalf of, well, I guess technically on behalf of Mr. Riedel, who is named in his capacity as the district attorney, but also as a representative of that office, which he is the head. Your Honor, I had intended perhaps to go through a little bit of the history of the case. I don't believe I'm going to use any time doing that. I think the court's very well aware from the briefings. Really what happened here, and what happened here factually, there's not a lot of disagreement about. Regarding the PRE itself, Mr. Foster, who's attempting to compel us to prosecute, it's very clear has taken great umbrage with this document and has gone to great lengths to, from the people's perspective, exact some matter of retribution for how this has gone for him. And that is in the form of individually suing John Plock, individually suing 11 different people who created the PRE he takes a disagreement with, seeking sanctions in the divorce case against Mr. Plock, and as well as the current matter. The only place where he's been successful is in the divorce case and getting some sanctions against Mr. Plock there. And as far as the standard, ultimately, and Judge Harris had a question about this, ultimately the standard, as I review the Cayley and the KSV Chambers case, this court applies a de novo standard to the district court's application of the abuse of discretion standard in assessing the prosecutor's decision. So I believe that procedurally is where we are at. Our position regarding why it is continues not to be appropriate to have felony criminal charges lodged against the two individuals rests in part on the distinction between medical record, medical information, and how those apply to theft of medical records under 18-4-412. It does continue to be our position that this case is fairly analogous to the People v. Palomo case, where the Supreme Court said, in that context of ostensibly medical information in the context of an employer's employee-employer file, that did not meet either definition, specifically because that was information that was gathered not for the purpose of treating a patient or acting on behalf of a patient, but for the purpose of the employer and making employment decisions. I think that is more analogous to the case here where we have a PRE, which, as I think I noted in my response, it may very well contain information of the kind that, were it in an appropriate document, would be a medical record or medical information. But my distinction, I believe, is that these are documents that were created as ordered by the court, not for the purpose of treating a patient or acting for a patient, and for the court's own purposes in deciding matters that it needed to decide in the divorce.
Mr. Vandenberg, let me stop you there. Let's assume the 8th JD, a DA's office, is wrong. Let's assume, for purposes of this discussion, that a PRE does fall under the statute concerning medical information. It looks as if you put a great deal of weight on that single factor, that legally the criminal statute doesn't apply. What if you're wrong? Would that not be arbitrary and capricious, and would that not be a reason to send the case back?
I don't believe it would be, for the other reasons that we cited in declining to prosecute, because it's not simply a matter of Mr. Riedel's initial reaction to Mr. Toff's request that we don't think these are medical records or medical information. Even if we are wrong, and I think this is something, and I guess my position is more in line with the question Judge Harris was asking counsel, even if we are arguably wrong, if the decision is unclear, if reasonable minds can disagree whether this qualifies as information or records or not, and that much is unclear to reasonable minds, then how can the decision not to bring criminal charges ever be arbitrary and capricious, where we have to look at whether we can meet that burden of proving that it would qualify as such beyond a reasonable doubt in front of a jury? And I don't think that a decision could fairly be characterized as arbitrary and capricious if it simply comes down to a disagreement, a legal disagreement among reasonable minds about what the import of those statutes are, whether it's a medical record, whether it's a medical information, or whether it is not. And so that's all by way of saying that is our position. I believe that it at worst is subject to disagreement among reasonable minds, and that being the case, the decision based on that can't be arbitrary and capricious, because we have to look at the end of the day, if reasonable people can disagree then of what the law actually is and whether the facts that we have in front of us actually constitute a crime, and the law is not settled on what we're giving to the jury to decide, how can that be considered arbitrary and capricious or an abuse of discretion? It's our position that it can't. But again, that really only is part of our continued decision that this should not be a prosecuted case. The other part are those equitable factors that we looked at. And I think I went through kind of line by line in our response brief in the district court about how those factors weighed so heavily against a decision to bring felony criminal charges here. And I won't go through all of them now. I know counsel's position was, well, we shouldn't be allowed to consider those factors because it's at this point was subsequent to the initial letter that DA Riedel sent him, which was really solely focused on whether we thought the definition of record or information had been met in this particular case. But the then leap to say that we are absolutely bound by that, we can't come back later and provide additional explanation for a reason not to prosecute, I don't believe is a valid position. And I think the district court in its order noted that really the whole purpose of ever having a hearing under 16-5-209 is explicitly to allow the people to elaborate on a decision not to prosecute. As it related to Deputy District Attorney Hardiman, the district court decided we did not need to have a hearing, so we didn't. But he did require one as to Attorney John Plock. We did go in writing and at the hearing and give a much more fleshed out reason why it continues not to be an abuse of discretion to bring the power of the state to charge someone with a felony under these circumstances. A couple of those things I wanted to highlight. One, a couple of those factors include a history of prosecuting this offense, other similarly situated defendants, and quite simply, I could find none. I saw one case in the entire history of our judicial district where theft of medical records had ever been charged, and that case was later dismissed. So one, I don't believe there are any similarly situated defendants, and two, one of the other factors in the National District Attorney Association standards is a history of non-enforcement of the statute, which apparently is there as well.
Is a factor what's to be gained? Is that one of the factors in the prosecution standards or the Sanchez case? And as a part of that question too, am I right that Mr. Hardwin prosecuted Mr. Plock at some point for a misdemeanor?
I don't know the details of that case. I do think that did occur at one point or another in the county court. I don't recall what the offense was for, but I think that is accurate. At some point in the past, prior to the criminal case against Mr. Foster that Mr. Hardwin prosecuted, I believe that John Plock was a defendant in the courtroom. I don't know what the resolution of that case was, if it was a trial case, if they ended up, you know, in a really adversarial position or not, but I think that is accurate, and I know counsel provided some records to that effect.
Okay, so then my primary question is the what's to be gained. Where does that show up in the factors?
So I know counsel's put a lot of emphasis on the phrasing of what's to be gained, and I think when D.A. Riedel said to the district court, we take charging decisions very seriously, and if we're going to levy our power to charge somebody criminally, we have to consider, he used the phrase, what is to be gained. I don't read that phrase, and I don't think a common sense meaning of that phrase could be anything other than we have to consider a number of factors to decide whether justice requires us to prosecute here. So that, I believe, is a much more fair reading of what he meant by what is to be gained. And that fleshes out, and I think that's just a way of encompassing the application of the prosecution standards that I undertook in my response in the district court. One, one other factor in those equitable considerations that I think really weighs heavily against prosecution is they allow us to look at what was the harm that was caused by the dissemination of the record. Even if you assume that it shouldn't have been done, you assume that it was a crime, what was the harm? In this case, what the record shows us at the county court is that Attorney Plock sent those PREs to District Attorney Hardwin, who filed them with the county court. There's no evidence that the PREs ever went beyond either DDA Hardwin or the county court. The evidence seemed very clear from the sentencing in the criminal matter that Deputy District Attorney Hardwin relied on the PRE only in asking that the court impose a condition of probation that the defendant have mental health treatment. The court, for its part, said essentially, to the extent I'm considering this PRE at all, it is only as it relates to the request for a mental health treatment as a condition of probation, and I'm not ordering it. So at the end of the day, the PRE went to Deputy DA Hardwin and went to the court after the sentencing. The court sealed the file, the district attorney purged their file. We no longer had the PRE at that point. The defendant's sentence, based on the disclosure of the PRE, ended up exactly the same as it would have been had the PRE not been there, because the court didn't order anything based on its review of the PRE. So Mr. Foster, in the end, based on the criminal allegations of theft of medical records, suffered no adverse consequence from the disclosure of these documents. They went to a district attorney whose files are not open to the public other than the parties in the case, and they went to the court who had it under seal, both of which, well, the court kept it under seal and the DA purged our files when the issue of the confidentiality provisions in Title 14 was raised regarding the PRE. There, one thing the district court focused on was, and which we also highlighted, is the fact that there were and have been other remedies available other than a felony criminal prosecution for the actions here. Mr. Plock was individually sued
I believe that that case at this point is up on, in the Court of Appeals. I'm not sure if it's in this division, but that is currently pending because it was not successful in the district court. Mr. Foster sought sanctions in the divorce court for Attorney Plock's disclosure of the record, and I believe he was successful in getting those sanctions. He had the ability and did so to sue fairly everybody that was involved in creating the PRE, and he was not successful in that endeavor either. The petitioner would have this court infer, and I think he acknowledged, and I appreciate that, that there isn't any evidence in the record showing that we are acting out of bias or bad faith, but he would like the court to infer that. I would point the court to the district court's decision in this matter, where it explicitly found no evidence of bias or bad faith motivating our office's decision to decline prosecution. And I think that that assertion by the district court is amply supported, mostly because there is an entire dearth of any evidence of improper motive on our part. Ultimately, Your Honors, the people have to be convinced that if we are going to bring criminal charges against somebody and potentially subject that person in a felony matter to a prison sentence, we have to be assured that the ultimate goal of doing justice would be advanced by taking that action. Where, as it is here, it is the people's position that it is very apparent that Mr. Foster is an individual who has endeavored and gone to great lengths to attempt to sort of strike out at those in the legal system who he feels have mistreated him or wronged him over the course of these past several years. It makes the desire to have these people prosecuted look a lot more like vengeance and not like justice. And I think that's supported by our application of the factors. Ultimately, I think the district court and this court can find that the district court fully and fairly considered all the necessary factors it needed to decide that our office had gone and undertaken a full and fair consideration of all the factors that underlie a charging decision, and decided that we had not been arbitrary and capricious, that we had given reasons to support our decision not to prosecute, and that it was therefore not an abuse of discretion. I understand that this court, as I already articulated, reviews the district court's application de novo, but I would point out that it is well-informed and it is well-reasoned. Therefore, it is our position that the defendant is not entitled to the relief he seeks, and the district court's order and the district attorney's decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vandenberg, and thank you, Mr. Toff, for your arguments today. Those arguments will be very helpful to the court in reaching a decision in this case. So the matter will now stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you very much for coming into court today, and we're glad to have you here. That's the end of our docket for the day, so counsel are excused, and court will stand in recess.